You're listening to Well Now, Slate's podcast on health and wellness. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. So a real vital component of wellness is really taking care of our mental health. Kavita, you and I have talked so much about what wellness is and what it isn't. And I think that every time we have this conversation, a new piece comes to mind for me. When we hear people talking about mental health and mental wellness, I know for me, for sure, that I know it's more than just drinking water or going for a walk or forest bathing, all good things, but it's so much more than that.
It is, Maya. And I think it's also so much more than just even talking about mental health or stigma with it. We know that at least one in six people probably have some sort of mental health diagnosis, often undiagnosed or underdiagnosed. One in eight in the world, according to the World Health Organization, live with a diagnosed mental disorder. So we're not talking about something that's rare or unusual. It's everywhere. And when you think about how many people we just have in our household, Maya, just under our roofs, there's a chance that one of us has something. So, and I certainly know that this affects me personally. I think we're going to try to talk about that. That's why it was important for us to try to find someone that could have a conversation with us, not just about what being well means in the context of mental health, but how you live, have relationships, and just have a life with mental illness.
You know, Kavita, I'm really interested in the idea of bringing this conversation into the mainstream. Just as you said, there's so many people that are either living with or know someone that is navigating a mental health challenge, but yet it's not openly discussed. And I feel like that does, like, society at large a significant disservice. So I'm very much looking forward to this conversation to really highlight some of these experiences, the lived experiences that people are having. And later on in the show, we're going to speak with someone who's found understanding around their own mental health through writing and building a community, like a pretty significant community online. However, Kavita, before we get to that, I'd like to actually know a little bit more from you. Like, how have you been navigating your own mental health?
Yeah, I probably did a very poor job of navigating mental health. I was brought up in an era and in a culture where mental health was and probably still is a shameful diagnosis, something to not speak about, something that you should try to just overcome. And I would say for me, it started in childhood. We now know there's something called adverse childhood events, ACEs, which is basically exposure to trauma. Even, Maya, something as simple as exposure to seeing a gun can lead to kind of longer term effects in your life and health and well-being. And I grew up around a lot of violence. I grew up in kind of the middle and the heart of, like, a pretty intense gang-infested neighborhood, and we ran a motel, and there were murders inside our motel. I didn't think about how much that affected me until I was in medical school and in fellowship and training, and the concept of ACEs came forward, and I thought, yeah, that was probably something that I, you know, should have had, like, help. We didn't even have school-based resources back then, so my experience probably started with the intense experience, but a lack of awareness. And then even as much as I'd like to say I'm a doctor, I'm very educated, I myself kind of deal with, as I mentioned, kind of these history of trauma and ongoing events, I can see sometimes in my day-to-day practice how I overlook other people's mental illness. We have a two-question screener that we use, something called a PHQ-2. It's a two question depression screener. We gloss over things. It's, you know, if you're not glaringly positive, we don't really stop and talk about it with people because, Maya, it takes time. And as we're going to learn from our guests, it's complicated. There is no one thing that all mental illness is not one diagnosis or one disease. And it manifests in so many different ways. And we're still learning a lot about it. So that's both my personal and professional experience. Maya, how about you?
Well, I'd say in my personal life, like every good New Yorker, I've been in therapy since I was 10. And I mean, I shouldn't laugh, but it's true. So I'm probably very well adjusted. And I always say that I'm really good at having a discussion and verbalizing every emotion and feeling that I'm having. The real question is, okay, so like, what do I do with those feelings? And how do I actually navigate through life as someone who has probably been over-therapeutized? I feel like when I was growing up, I had a lot of access to mental health care. And I mean, I grew up in this mixed race lesbian home, so that was just outside of the norm. And because everyone was so progressive, there was a lot of discussion and talking about identity and awareness. And so that was beautiful then. It wasn't until I got to college, Kavita, that I realized, holy shit, I am totally the anomaly here. Like, talk about unicorn and in the room. That was me. Yeah. So therapy has been a mainstay in my experience. And I think in my work, this is what I know to be true, because nutrition has that medical nutrition therapy component. I end up working pretty closely with a number of people who have mental health diagnoses and helping them navigate how to nourish themselves in the face of whatever the diagnosis is. And we often see the same person for a fairly long period of time, anywhere from 3 months to a year, for 30, 45, or 60 minutes. So I get to know people fairly intimately, and it's slow, slow, slow work. And I think somehow that therapy that I've done for myself helps me as a provider to slow down, listen, and be present in a different way. And I think my family would probably say that I'm like too tough with them because I'm too caring with everyone else. Let's bring another voice into this conversation. So when we come back, we'll talk with someone who's written about how she's navigated her life and close relationships while living with mental illness. Stay tuned.
Hey, Well Now listeners, if you're enjoying the show and want to hear more, subscribe to our feed. New episodes come out every Wednesday morning. While you're there, check out other episodes too, like last week's about how our understanding of autism has changed over the years with caregiving reporter Sarah Luderman. Check it out. Welcome back. You're listening to Well Now. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. Joining us to talk about wellness and mental health is Allison Raskin, who recently wrote about how OCD affects her marriage for Slate. She's also co-host of the podcast Just Between Us, which is incredibly hilarious, by the way, and the author of Overthinking About You, Navigating Romantic Relationships When You Have Anxiety, OCD, and or Depression. Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It is a pleasure. Okay, so before we get started, I want to ask you this question that we ask everyone. And as Kavita says, which I love so much, it's not a gotcha question, just we want to know. So how do you define wellness?
Oh, that's such a tricky term because I feel like it's been monopolized by an industry trying to gouge us for money. So I have I always tend to talk about like one's mental health and physical health, but wellness, I guess, to me is when you don't feel like you want to die. If that makes sense.
That's a good one. Yes. That is.
Yes. Yes. And that resonates. That resonates.
Yeah. When you're doing well enough that you're like, I want to continue where I am and what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. And it's so true. It's definitely been monopolized, but I think that's why we like to ask it, because I think your words are just as much of where we are and thinking about day to day what being well means for at least, I would say probably the three of us now. I resonate with that. So we're talking, Allison, just so much the richness around your writing, but specifically around maintaining wellness while living and dealing with mental illness. I'll say I love to kind of remind people that, like, you know, healthcare doesn't stop at your neck. There's like so much about your mental health that has everything to do with all aspects of your health and your life. Can you share your experience of your mental health journey and just how it's affected your life.
Yes. Yeah, so mine started pretty early. When I was 4 years old, I got strep throat, and that sort of set off this thing called PANDAS.
And I'll do a little PSA. PANDAS is short for Pediatric Autoimmune Neuropsychiatric Disorders Associated with Strep, if I'm not mistaken, just for people listening who might not know PANDAS.
Yeah, I never bothered to remember what it actually stood for, but it is basically when a neurological thing is brought on by strep throat, which basically means that it ignited OCD, and an OCD that came on really strong and really fast, to the point where my parents got me like tested to see if I had a brain tumor because my behavior had changed so quickly. But I was really, really lucky because, you know, this is like back in like 93, 94. And when like talking about mental health, taking mental health seriously wasn't really people's jam yet. But they got me into a doctor who took it super seriously. And I ended up going to, I lived in New York, and we went down to Johns Hopkins to see a specialist who was working with giving kids medication. And so I was put on Prozac when I was 4 years old, which was like pretty rad and new. And like, I'm just so glad that my family was like, yep, this is what we need to do. She's sick. We need to treat it like an illness. And so I don't have any reference point for not being mentally ill. Like, I don't have any idea of what it means to exist in the world without having OCD and some level of anxiety coursing through my body. And it's been an interesting journey because the things that really are hard was more like the generalized anxiety and the bouts of depression. And I feel like I have really gotten those under control as I've gotten older and as I've gone back on medication, because, of course, I had my rebellions of I don't need medication, which was like, wow, how different my 20s could have been if I was just medicated. And so now I'd say that like what's really the main thing left over is the OCD and is the contamination OCD. And that is the final frontier where it just feels like, okay, I've done a lot of work on myself. I've gotten myself to a much better place. I don't have suicidal ideation anymore. I'm in a healthy relationship. I enjoy my life, but my contamination OCD remains.
I was watching your podcast Just Between Us, and I have to say that you do this amazing thing where you are so honest and so humble.
Just Between Us.
Hey! Welcome back to Just Between Us, your weekly dose of animal videos.
That would probably get a lot of views.
That would do better than our show.
Yeah, I agree.
But then at the same time, just super wry about your experience, and you just draw people in and really do a job of destigmatizing the experiences that you have. So it makes it so relatable to everyone, including those of us that don't have a diagnosis of OCD, depression, or anxiety.
A compulsion is something that you need to do to relieve the discomfort from your obsession, right? Mm-hmm. But I also know that a lot of my compulsions are annoying and rude.
From your perspective, living with OCD and other mental illnesses, what do you think is the part that's most misunderstood?
So I think a big misunderstanding with OCD is how debilitating it is. And so OCD is, I kind of used to call it like the grab bag of mental illness. Like, it is one disorder, but the way that it can present is so varied. And my experience of OCD might be completely different than your experience of OCD, and also the level and impact that it has on our lives. And so for me, I personally have the type of OCD that we see in a sitcom, right? Like, I have a contamination-based OCD. I do a lot of cleaning behaviors and compulsions. But for other people, their OCD might have absolutely nothing to do with organization. Mine's not really about organizations. Mine's about contamination, which in and of itself is a difference, right? And then they might have harm OCD. So all that they're worried about is that they're going to hurt somebody. And so it is like an internal struggle that you might not even understand that they're dealing with. And so I'd say that like the flippancy with which we often refer to OCD is a big misunderstanding. But also, as I, you know, I got a a master's degree in psychology so that I could talk about this stuff from outside of my own experience. And something that I used to do wrong was that I was a gatekeeper of the OCD diagnosis. And so when someone would say like, oh, I'm OCD too, I would be like, when were you diagnosed? You know, because I felt like that was like a way of someone just like minimizing this disorder. But having gone to school and having learned so much, like, I much prefer the approach to diagnosis as a spectrum rather than categorical, where you have it or you don't. And obviously, there's a use for categorical in terms of like getting a clinical diagnosis. But in terms of like our day-to-day lives and our experiences, it really is a spectrum. And so who am I to say that like even if you don't meet the clinical diagnosis of having OCD because these compulsions don't take up a certain amount of time or cause you a certain level of distress, that you don't have OCD tendencies. And so I think a lot of people have OCD tendencies. The difference is just like, how big is that impact, you know? And like, when it is really impacting your life and the way that you function, then, okay, this is something that's, you know, we're maybe going to put that in your chart. We're maybe going to get you that help, that medication, the ERP therapy. But I think a lot of people have some tendencies. And then in terms of like mental health in general, I think we're getting better at understanding the importance of mental health. But I also think that our acceptance level as a society has sort of stopped at anxiety, depression.
Agreed. I agree 100%.
And like we are ignoring all the people dealing with mania, dealing with psychosis. And I hope that the next wave of understanding and acceptance includes all mental disorders and even the ones that sort of scare us or feel like unrelatable to the more mainstream experience.
Allison, in your opinion, why do you feel like society has kind of stopped at just the anxiety and depression? Why not open the conversation up in the mainstream?
I think it's too scary. Like, I think psychosis is something that, having learned about it but not experienced it, and not, I never did practicum because I didn't do a clinical degree, so I never worked with clients, and therefore I never worked with anyone with psychosis. You know, I think it's something that we've only seen portrayed as this scary thing on TV and in media. And so we don't understand like that there are people that we might know that are living with schizophrenia, or that like what it actually means for our bipolar friend to have hypomania and the impact that that has on their life. As a society, we can only move forward so much. And it's really easy to say like, oh, I understand mental health because I understand anxiety and depression, but like you don't even know what it's like to have a delusional disorder. That still is like something to make fun of.
And I think there's so much one stigma in general, but then it's almost like there's so much education to be, you know, depression has become a little bit more of this like, or anxiety. And then when you start, to your point, talking about delusional disorder, personality disorders, obsessive compulsive disorders, people are like, oh gosh, they're just crazy. You know, the stigma of anything just kind of pours back in, and it's so destructive, which is why it's been so refreshing to have, I think, a lot of people, but especially you leading, just talking about you know, how OCD affects other aspects of your life. Honestly, I found the intersection with how you've kind of navigated relationships, just parts of your Substack, and just kind of, you know, relationships and others who've chimed in about how like their OCD affected dating and marriages. Can you just tell us a little bit more about this intersection with relationships and what that looks like? And I'm smiling because a lot of it is humorous and just very, it's just downright funny. But tell us about your journey there.
It's definitely like kind of two parts, right? Because there's the part of your mental health that is just your everyday life, and therefore your partner needs to understand how your mental health functions and how your symptoms interfere with your life and how to be an empathetic and caring partner. And then there's the part of your mental health that directly impacts your relationship and your ability to be in a relationship. And I think that that first part of like just my mental health impacts my daily life and my partner therefore needs to understand how my brain works, still there in my marriage. Whereas like I was able to get to a place where like my mental health was under control enough that it wasn't impacting my ability to be in a relationship. But I think for a lot of people, this thing called relationship OCD or relationship anxiety can really get in the way of their ability to be in a long-term committed relationship because they are constantly wondering either if they're in the right relationship, like, are they in love? This constant feeling of like, what is love? Am I feeling love correctly? Do I have enough love? And then also on the flip side, like an obsession around like, does my partner love me? Like, is my part, like, am I good enough for my partner? And that's exhausting. And I think because, you know, our OCD hasn't, it's been getting more momentum and more people are familiar with it. But like, even me, I didn't know what it was. I maybe learned about it 5 years ago and I've had OCD my whole life. And so really understanding like, hey, like, am I just haven't found the right person yet? Versus like, am I in a loop in my brain that makes it impossible for me to feel like I'm in the right relationship?
Allison, before you had spoken a little bit about your 20s and you said, oh, had I known, what was the had I known?
I think that I'm someone that needs medication. My thoughts around medication have changed and fluctuated a lot. I think for a long time, I thought that medication was just great for everybody and worked as effectively for everybody as it does for me. And unfortunately, that's not the case. Some people have tried a bunch of medications and none of them are helpful, and that really sucks. Or the side effects are too intense that it's not worth it. But for me, I'm someone, and I think I can trace this back to the fact that my OCD is very biologically based, right? Like going back to that pandas, it's like really like a biological genetic predisposition brought on by strep throat. Like logically, it makes sense that like, oh, that's the kind of thing that like medication will probably help and work with. But I had this aversion to it in my 20s, and I took myself off of my meds the summer before my senior year of college because I was like, oh, I don't need this. And like, it's again, like, what does need mean? In my 20s, I built an incredible career that like, honestly, is better than the career I have now. Like I hit like a peak of my career. I was very professionally successful. I had a lot of fun. I did a lot of cool things, but I was also suffering a lot. And something that my psychiatrist always says is like, why do you have to white knuckle your way through life? Right? Like I can white knuckle my way through life. I can get it all done and do it all and accomplish my goals, but I might be miserable doing that. And the medication piece for me takes that extra struggle away. It doesn't alleviate all of my symptoms. It doesn't mean I don't have OCD anymore, but it just has quieted the noise. And like the baseline of where I start is higher than where it is when I'm off meds. And so that means that like, I have more wiggle room in terms of when I have a bad phase, I'm not going as far down as I did in the past.
So much more to talk about, but let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to hear more from Allison Raskin about maintaining wellness and living with mental illness. Stay tuned. You're listening to Well Now from Slate. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. We're continuing our conversation with Allison Raskin about maintaining wellness and healthy relationships while living with mental illness. So Allison, in 2020, you started this Instagram account called Emotional Support Lady. Can you tell us a little bit about what that project is?
So that project is one of those things where I was like, I should create an Instagram that's just mental health focused, because at the time I was already a mental health advocate, but I had started grad school. And so I was like, I'm learning all of these like fascinating things in grad school. I want to like share it, but also it like feels weird to interrupt my main Instagram, which is like a lot of like comedy and weird stuff with factual, you know, scientific based mental health information. And so I thought of the term emotional support lady in probably like 5 minutes and then started this Instagram, not realizing kind of what it would become. From that Instagram, I started it in 2020, like you said, and it was sort of at the beginning, I was just sort of doing that regular thing of Canva designs and sort of looked like everyone else's. And then I ended up drawing this one post because I had a visual in my head and I don't know how to use graphics. So I was like, I'll just draw this thing. And it was me like drawing like what my mental health journey looks like. And it was like a line of peaks and valleys and ups and downs and all of that. And then I just like, I don't know, I guess I did another cartoon and I am not skilled in fine motor abilities. Like my handwriting looks like maybe a 5-year-old who might turn out to be problematic. Like it's just like I have horrible handwriting. But I ended up having this amazing conversation with one of my good friends, Sarah Romanoff, who was in advertising and was an artistic director. And she was like, Allison, like, I think as you're building this thing, just stay with the cartoons. Even though these cartoons are stick figures with almost illegible captions. And I was like, all right, like, I understand branding. I worked at BuzzFeed. Like, I'm going to continue in this path. And so basically from, like, the first week or two, the account has been these cartoons that I draw. And then I decided at a certain point, my manager suggested that I turn that into a Patreon, but then I got poached by Patreon to work on Substack. And so now I've had a Substack for the last couple of years called Emotional Support Lady. And each post includes one of my super talented cartoons. And it's just been wonderful to see that like people have kind of like gravitated towards it. And I think that part of what really kicked off the account, aside from the audience I already had from Just Between Us, was in November of 2020, my fiance at the time just like abruptly left me. And it was like very shocking and destabilizing and horrific. And I was like, oh no, I've started this mental health account that I'm supposed to be posting on every single day. And I'm going through one of the worst periods of my entire life. Do I hide that from them? Or do I just really share and explore the feelings that I'm feeling as I'm going through what I'd like to call the great abandonment? And so I decided, all right, I've always been honest with my fans. I mean, I took a couple weeks to make sure he wasn't coming back. You know, I didn't want to jinx it. And then when it became clear he was gone, I was like, well, I might as well. And so I started sharing that healing journey while I was in it. And the amount of people that were like had similar stories, had partners that had just up and left, or just people going through heartbreak in general, I think that that really like kind of fueled the beginning of the account. And then you could almost go back and trace like how that then took up less and less of my mind, you know, that like so much of it was based on loss and heartbreak. And then over time, it just became life because I had moved forward.
Do you remember any of the DMs or responses from your fans that you would be willing to share with us?
Oh, I don't remember specifics, but I remember being absolutely blown away by the amount of people who had been abruptly left by long-term partners. And I think at the time, I thought that what had happened to me was like very unusual to have like no warning. I've not seen that guy since the night he broke up with me. I had like one very brief FaceTime the next day and one 20-minute phone call where he told some horrible, mean things. So he was just like gone. Like there was like no closure. There was no like, let's work through this. And to learn that like so many other people had similar experiences was wild because I, you know, the fact that people do that, but I also think that like people do that because that's the only way they can leave is something that I understand now, where it's like they have to shut themselves off. They have to like almost like turn into another person so that they can like get themselves from this relationship to the next part of their life. And they don't understand like the collateral damage of that.
And in your writing, you feel like you're processing so much of your lived experience. Do you feel like this has shifted as you've grown older to better understand your specific diagnosis and the different ways that you could actually cope with the experiences that you're having?
I've actually had like an interesting journey with my relationship towards OCD. And this is probably where my views as a mental health advocate are likely the most controversial. So get ready. Because when it comes to OCD, the main line of defense is exposure therapy, right? It's that you are not supposed to give in to your compulsions. You are supposed to fight them at every turn, and that you're supposed to constantly expose yourself to the things that cause you distress so that the OCD can't grow and instead you're shrinking it. And I have kind of, with time and with acceptance of myself and with all of the growth that I have made on the other aspects of my life, I've kind of come to a place where I don't want to spend every moment of my life fighting this thing. And so instead of this sort of like pure approach of exposure and no reassurance from other people and no one giving in to your compulsions, I instead have a real new harm reduction approach to my OCD where I'm looking at it, I'm looking at the way it affects my life, and I'm saying, you know what? Me wiping my cell phone down 4 times a day, who is that hurting? Like, it's not interfering with my relationships. It's not interfering with my work. It means that I'm not uncomfortable all day for no reason other than I'm putting up a fight. And so really approaching my OCD with a values-based approach rather than an all-or-nothing approach has been really helpful for me. So it's sort of like, does giving into this compulsion interfere with my values? Right. So, for example, I had a party at my house and it was really hot out and I didn't think it would be that hot. So I had planned for it to be an outdoor party. But then it was like people are going to need to be inside. And so I was like, well, I'm going to not make people take their shoes off because my value here is that my friends are comfortable and having a good time in my home. And also, I already have people coming to clean my home tomorrow. So I could probably tolerate that one night of it not being clean. And so I will push through the discomfort that comes from people having shoes in my house because of my values versus every compulsion I have, I should be fighting and no one should ever appease me, which a lot of OCD advocates and experts are going to disagree with that. But I've found as I've gotten older and more sure of myself and figured out more what I want my day-to-day life to look like, that's what works for me.
I think that just that example, you almost kind of planned for allowing for your OCD to kind of align with your values in that moment. And it doesn't have to always be that way. You're not going to always just want random people coming in with their shoes on.
Right.
But in that moment, for that circumstance, and in a way you planned for it and didn't allow for it to kind of penetrate and like perseverate, which is obviously kind of classic features that accompany OCD. So how can we extend, I love this wisdom, can we, in trying to kind of round out some of this, give advice? If you were talking to someone who's been either recently diagnosed with OCD or another mental illness, what are some pieces of advice you would give them for just keeping exactly kind of the way you phrased it, maintaining your values and kind of keeping yourself well from your perspective?
So I really like this approach that's, I think, kind of pulled from narrative therapy, where I view my OCD as something outside of myself. And again, people are going to disagree. Everyone has their own relationships to their diagnosis and disorders and the way that they approach themselves. But for me, externalizing my OCD and externalizing my anxiety as something that is not Allison, but instead is something that Allison has to deal with, is super helpful. Because I think, especially when you get a new diagnosis, it's really important to figure out what your opinion about the fact that you have a diagnosis is. Because if you feel shame around that diagnosis, that's just going to like be an extra weight on top of all the symptoms that you're dealing with. And it's just going to make everything extra hard. Whereas if you can get to a place of acceptance where it's like, yeah, like in the same way, maybe I would have diabetes or I would have, you know, fibromyalgia. I have OCD and this is this thing that I have, but is not me and something that I need to deal with, but doesn't define me. And is this thing on top of me rather than my truth? I think it becomes an easier thing to deal with. And so I really love just even the visual. And like you'll see in some of my cartoons, it's me talking to my OCD that like, this is this thing that thinks that it's helping me, thinks that it's protecting me. But ultimately I have to be like, hey, actually, please leave me alone.
We're coming to the end of our time. Anything that we didn't get to touch on or ask you since you've been able to bring so much of this out for people and give them voice in ways, relationships, love, friendships, and all the good and bad in between.
Circling back to relationships, I think there is a sense often that if you're someone that has struggled with your mental health, that you are more difficult to love, that you are maybe unlovable. Also that maybe you should take what you can get in terms of a partner because, like, thank God this person is willing to put up with me or that type of thinking. And so I really like to push back against that and instead say, for those of us who have struggled with our mental health, we have had to do a lot of work that other people haven't had to do. And that work, working on ourselves, emotional regulation, understanding how our brain works, empathy for ourselves and other people, all of those things actually end up often making us better partners. So instead of feeling like, oh, I gotta take what I can get, instead think of it as like, wow, I have already done so much work that will make me a wonderful partner for whoever I end up wanting to commit to.
Well, this was a great conversation. Allison Raskin is a writer, podcast host, and mental health advocate. She also has a new book coming out later this year called I Do, I Think, Conversations About Modern Marriage. So looking forward to reading that. Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. This was wonderful.
That's our show this week. Well Now is produced by Vic Whitley Berry. Ben Richman is Slate's Senior Director of Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio.
We'd love to hear from you. Email us at wellnow@slate.com. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday as we tackle another part of the wellness industry. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. Thank you for listening.